Hello, everyone, and welcome. My name is Sarah Krebs, and I am a professor of government and law and the head of the Tech Policy Institute at Cornell University. I will be your moderator for the podcast today, Crypto Policy and AI Lab. New crypto policy could stifle innovation and economy. We are delighted to have with us on our panel today, Susan Joseph, a lawyer and consultant and the executive director of the FinTech Initiative at Cornell Business School, John Wu, president of Ava Labs, and Jason Schwartz, tax partner and co-head of digital assets at Creed Frank. So we are thrilled to be incorporating both the academy and industry together to discuss crypto's critical moment in the US. So we're talking about the future of crypto from a regulatory standpoint, and I'm going to ask Jason to kick us off to explain what concerns are in this current moment poses and why we're here talking about it today.
Yeah. So we are currently facing an existential threat to digital asset innovation in the United States under newly proposed IRS regulations that the IRS can finalize, you know, however it wants, when it wants. The regulations would effectively ban blockchain innovation and the use of crypto within the United States under the guise of information reporting. Right now, the proposed regulations are proposed. There's a comment period that ends on November 13th. After that, the IRS is required to consider all comments, but it's not required to take any comments. And then it can finalize the regulations, having considered the comments, in their current form. And if it does so, effectively, everyone involved at all in blockchain technology would be treated as a broker and effectively barred from being able to do any blockchain innovation in the United States because the regulations would impose too great a burden on those persons. And anyone outside of the United States who doesn't want to fall under this rubric would have to block U.S. people from using their products.
Wow. Well, this sounds like a really big deal. And it sounds like there have been a lot of comments already. And so there's still some time for others to make comments. Susan, why could you add to this? Why is this such a big deal?
Yep. So I want to put my answer in some context. Crypto is still what I would consider a nascent industry, but it's found its product market fit 15 years after its start. If you compare that to the internet took about 20 years to find product market fit. And, you know, before then we had a lot of naysayers, just like today we have a lot of naysayers with crypto. But finding the product market fit, which I think is stablecoins, I think we should be really excited and energized by this because it looks like it's going to usher in a way to have more inclusive financial access. Instead, I am sounding the red alert, all hands on deck, any possible metaphor that you could use, because I think this is truly, as Jason said, an existential moment. This rule that the IRS proposes and can enact if it feels like it would drive this industry and all modernization, and that means all jobs about the economy and all economy impacts offshore. Now, if you look at what the IRS predicted in 2021, when it was first talking about these kinds of rules, it said it would receive $28 billion if this new rule was created. Well, I'm going to say that $28 billion, first of all, in new taxes is just a percentage of what the entire value of the economic landscape is for this type of innovation and technology. But also, there's no way that $28 billion is coming into the IRS coffers if this rule is passed, because the industry is going to vaporize. It is just not going to happen here. And so that to me is kind of a false number, saying that they're going to get a certain amount of revenue when in reality it will be pretty close to a goose egg. So all of this means I think that there is a terrible economic loss in the USA. And I want to also point out for Web3, most positions are remote. So if you're working in Web3, it can be in a big city, but it can also be in middle America. And so this affects jobs everywhere. And it's a huge loss of economic opportunity, which I think has not been emphasized.
I would like to, as an operator in this space, I want to attach a few stories related to that. Ava Labs was actually, I'm a Cornell graduate. Ava Labs was founded by a Cornell professor, and the technology, the consensus protocol, was commercialized. Ava Labs is a software services company, but it's responsible for the permissionless open blockchain Avalanche, just to be clear. Now, Ava Labs, since the beginning, 4 or 5 years ago, has hired, just from Cornell alone, about 70 Cornell-related students and provided jobs with them. And we are in the New York City area, so most of these kids came to New York to work. If this were to happen, as Jason described it, there's go 70 jobs from Cornell alone, not even including the other, you know, call it roughly 150 or 60 people that work at Ava Labs in the US. It will be very difficult to tell these people to try to move, because what they want to do is impossible in the US.
Wow. Well, thanks, John, for that industry perspective. I wonder, taking a step back here, Jason, whether we could talk a little bit about kind of what the genesis of this, because this current IRS interpretation is of a law that was passed 2 years ago. What could you talk a little bit more? This was in the IIJA. What aspect of this is now being interpreted? Can you kind of do a somewhat deeper dive on this?
Yeah. Let's do it. So first, just very, very basic concept. When I sell stock through my broker, let's say, you know, JP Morgan, I don't have direct access to the gross proceeds from my sale of that stock, right? JP Morgan sells the stock on my behalf. And in order to know how much, you know, how much gain or loss I had, JP Morgan has to tell me. So there is a 1099 reporting regime that people who have ever sold stock are familiar with, where JP Morgan sends a 1099 to me and a copy to the IRS. And that 1099 says, okay, Jason, you know, here's your amount realized on your sale. It also includes my basis if JP Morgan has that information. Really important in the sort of private ledger space, which is, you know, the historical space that that has existed forever, you know, pre-blockchain. Now, Congress realized in 2021 that there's no similar regime for crypto, or at least that the regime for crypto is unclear. Centralized exchanges, you know, your Coinbase, Kraken, Gemini, et cetera, did not have an explicit requirement to provide 1099s to people when those exchanges sold crypto on their behalves. Even if they wanted to, some of these exchanges actually do provide 1099s, but are unclear on which 1099 to use, because there are several different series of 1099s, what exactly to report, how to report it, et cetera. So Congress determined in connection with the IIJA to modify the tax code to explicitly say, hey, digital assets are also subject to 1099 reporting, and brokers, digital asset brokers, should do that reporting. Now, IRS, go and do your thing. Define digital asset and define broker. In connection with that modification, the Senate, in the legislative history, explicitly told the IRS, do not interpret this provision to change the traditional understanding of what a broker was. So that's really important, right? And a broker has always been someone who either acts as an agent, right? So like a custodian, or someone who's selling stock or bonds or other financial instruments on my behalf, or a principal whose business is to trade directly against me, right? Because JP Morgan might just trade directly against me, in which case they would also provide a 1099 to me. But it's always been someone with a customer relationship. Now, what did the IRS do in response to this rule? in August of this year, they issued proposed regulations interpreting broker. And notwithstanding Congress's explicit desire, and by the way, the plain language of the statute, which says that, you know, that you're supposed to expand 1099 reporting to someone who effectuates transfers of digital assets on behalf of another person. So effectuates, like causes a transfer of digital assets on someone's behalf. Notwithstanding all of that, the proposed regulations do two things. Number one, they define digital asset as anything tokenized. So not just like, you know, your typical Bitcoin or Ether or tokenized stocks and bonds, but also NFTs. You know, even though the sort of analog in the real world, like collectibles, is not subject to 1099 reporting. Also stable coins, even though cash is not subject to 1099 reporting. So that's number one. They created an extremely broad definition of what is subject to reporting. And then they created an extremely broad, really limitless definition of who has to report. And that limitless definition takes the word effectuates in the statute, right? Someone who effectuates transfers of digital assets, and basically says, okay, we're going to define that to mean anyone who directly or indirectly effectuates. And indirectly is totally limitless. So it includes website developers. If a website, they say, facilitates someone's sale of digital assets, then the website is a broker. Wallets. So you know, when I sell digital assets directly from my wallet, like if I use my wallet to buy a coffee, you know, digital assets are just like digital cash. If I use my wallet like to just spend crypto or stable coins on a cup of coffee, the payment processor and the wallet are both brokers. So basically, software developers now, even though they have nothing to do with the actual sale, other than that they created software that I use to make the sale, they're brokers. And why are they brokers, according to the regs? Because they could have changed the nature of their business to demand my name, address, and social security number as a condition to my using their software. So in other words, any website or wallet or other software that involves crypto would have to geo-block out anyone who doesn't provide them with their names, addresses, and social security numbers. And then they, you know, and then they have to collect that information, somehow store it privately, securely, even though, you know, many of these software developers are leanly staffed fintechs, right? And then report every sale and other, you know, transfer to the IRS and to me. So literally I would have to KYC in order to buy a cup of coffee at Starbucks using a stable coin.
I mean, Jason, that is so detailed and very helpful, Jason. As an operator and a builder, I focus on products, so I don't have the benefit of understanding the granular details like you just described. But I have a benefit of looking at it from a different perspective as a builder and an innovator. From a top-down perspective, listening to all that, it's very clear to me that regulation in general is about intermediaries. And this entire space is the antithesis of that. It is open, permissionless, and it's not about intermediaries. It's about removing intermediaries. So to force fit a framework on how to legislate when the entire space is about a different ethos, that's going to be a challenge in fairness to the legislators and regulators, but also it may miss the point.
I mean, I think that's exactly right. What the regulations would do if finalized in their current form is not take intermediaries and say, hey, intermediaries, you now have to report, which I think is clearly what Congress intended, but instead take people who are clearly not intermediaries and say, hey, you have to become an intermediary.
It re-centralizes.
Yes.
And, you know, again, the spirit and the ethos of this is self-sovereignty, having decentralization so everyone feels more empowered. I mean, this has been happening already in Web2 with seven large companies basically controlling a decent amount of the S&P market cap, as well as everyone's individual lives. This is one way to give power back to the individual, as well as the young innovator and the entrepreneur, but this law will completely stymie that.
And it's also really important to think about just how broad the regulations are, in that they effectively give the IRS authority, you know, the IRS is giving itself authority to treat anyone it wants as a broker, right? Because it's frankly impossible to determine the limitations of these regulations. And I can't stress that enough. I mean, what does it mean to directly or indirectly effectuate a transaction? The regulations don't provide any guidance on any governors of indirectly, which means arguably a smartphone manufacturer is a broker if the IRS wants it to be. Google is a broker. Yahoo Finance is a broker. Because all of these things, facilitate, indirectly effectuate a transaction. And in theory, could have requested your social security number as a precondition to your using them. So imagine all of these information honeypots now. Like, I mean, one, you have to question whether this is even constitutional, right? But like, let's assume the regulations are finalized in their current form. It means you really like can't Google, how do I effectuate a crypto transaction without Google, having a block, a block window and saying, oh, now, Jason, you have to give your name, address, and social security number and tell us whether you use this information to actually do a transaction, because we're concerned that we're helping you indirectly effectuate a transaction. It's really kind of unconscionable.
So just a quick thing, because Jason and I both mentioned the IIJA, which is the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. I just wanted to clarify that. But one other thing I wanted to ask is, so we've talked about this comment period that is coming to an end on November 13th. What is plausible? So we've talked about the concerns that we have. What's actually plausible that could come out of the comment period that could shift the IRS interpretation? I mean, is there precedent for public comments actually changing interpretation? How should we think about this?
Yeah, there is. As I mentioned, the Administrative Procedure Act does not require the IRS to accept comments or implement comments, but it does require them to consider and respond to every significant comment made. And typically the way the IRS does that is in connection with finalizing regulations, it issues what's called a preamble, effectively like an essay explaining what comments were made and what the IRS thinks about the comments. In theory, it could just list out the comments and say, we considered and rejected this comment. There is lots of precedent for the government and particularly the IRS, which historically has been a really thoughtful agency. I have a lot of respect for the people who work there, considering comments and taking them to heart. So far, this proposal has garnered a lot of attention. There, people have been writing in, community members have been writing in. I've written in. Look, if you're concerned about, jobs in the U.S. and the U.S.'s ability to lead on innovation, you write into the IRS. And it's very easy to do so. There are a number of organizations that have made available AI tools that help even non-lawyers, even non-tax lawyers write in. One such tool that I'm particularly fond of is available at treasuryraid.lexpunk.army. Lexpunk is a loose conglomerate of lawyers, accountants, technologists. They created this AI tool that has read and digested the proposed regulations. It gives you drop-down menu of different concerns that you might raise. You can also fill in your own concern. You can choose the tone, and then it links you to the comment submission window. I highly encourage anyone who is at all concerned about these regulations, and frankly, anyone who's concerned about the U.S. And innovation in the U.S. should be concerned about these regulations, to visit that website and submit a comment. You have until November 13th. Again, it's treasuryraid.lexpunk.army.
So one other thing procedurally, so the IAJA was also euphemistically referred to as the bipartisan infrastructure law. Is there at this point any accountability from Congress to step back in? I mean, it seems like the IRS is appropriating a fair amount of power with this. Is there any accountability mechanism back from Congress to say, you know, you've taken this in a direction that we didn't envision?
I don't know the answer to that. I think more likely is that if the regulations are finalized in their current form, they'd be subject to a legal challenge in court first. Congress can, of course, revise the statute, pass a technical revision that even further clarifies that effectuates really means effectuates. But short of that, I mean, the IRS has interpretive authority, and they are, I think they're going far beyond interpretation, but, that's where we're at right now.
Susan, I'm curious, as a lawyer, what do you think of this lawsuit idea?
So I think it's entirely possible, in fact, very likely, that you would see a big challenge under the Administrative Procedures Act, which likely would make its way up to the Supreme Court, who is very not friendly to agencies overstepping their charters, so to speak. So I think that there's a very good likelihood, but that sort of goes through the courts, and that does take a while. On top of that, if it really does impact companies like Google or any other, Yahoo Finance, et cetera, I would imagine that there would be a fair amount of litigation coming from that end. And certainly from there would be a class action lawyer bonanza, I would think, on this. So I think that this triggers a whole meltdown of, or jobs for lawyers, if you want to look at it like that. I also want to step back to, though, and kind of a separate issue that Jason brought up, where whether or not it's constitutional. You have to look at what the surveillance mechanism is. Do I want to buy surveillance coffee? Because that's essentially what you're doing when you're telling Starbucks or a diner, if you accept a stablecoin, you now have to KYC or know your customer and ask me for my name, my address, my social security number, and any other thing just to process surveilled coffee. I think that that is really outrageous. And I would definitely see a number of constitutional challenges on that. And by the way, any lawyers that might want to do that, I'd be happy to weigh in for you.
It's also worth just pointing out how, for those who don't know, if I go to a website involving crypto, the website has literally no reason to know, truly no reason to know who I am or even whether I engage in the relevant transaction. Even a website that is a marketplace, all it does is enable people to connect with each other. The regulations explicitly carve out in real life marketplaces. So a stock exchange itself is not a broker under current regulations. Craigslist marketplace, Facebook marketplace, they're not brokers. Flea markets are not brokers, right? It's very, very strange for the IRS to nevertheless say, hey, we're going to treat a crypto related marketplace as a broker. I'm just sort of illustrating just how far these regulations go. In addition, there's been a lot of a lot of sort of bullishness on crypto relating to these potential ETF approvals. The regulations also would require many ETFs to somehow, not just 1099 people when they sell their ETF shares. So brokers, you know, if I sell my ETF shares through JP Morgan, JP Morgan has to give me a 1099, which is, again, is uncontroversial. But somehow they would also have to figure out a way to give me a 1099 for the underlying Bitcoin or Ether or whatever the crypto is, which could be highly problematic. You know, two sets of 1099s. Frankly, it's not even clear to me how that how financial institutions would comply with that requirement. So, look, I mean, all industry participants within crypto, I think, are up in arms over these proposed regulations. But I think it is important to understand that this goes beyond crypto. I mean, this effectively enables the IRS to treat as a broker anyone it wants to kill, really. And in that sense, you know, bringing it back to the constitutional argument, you know, there is this, I think that these proposed regulations very possibly violate the Fourth Amendment's prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures. You know, the third party doctrine cases under the Fourth Amendment do, I think, do not go so far as to enable the IRS to just deputize anyone it wants to collect information. But the regulations are also void for vagueness and therefore violate the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution because they effectively give the IRS unfettered authority to just go after anyone it wants to treat as a broker. And really any technology firms, you know, including smartphone manufacturers and web browsers and, you know, and really like internet service providers should really be shaking in their boots seeing these proposed regulations, even if they don't currently deal directly with crypto.
I mean, John, it seems like this would have a huge impact on startups and innovation just because of the time and cost involved with compliance. Is that your sense as well?
Absolutely. It's the operational cost to service this, the time it would cost individuals who want to focus on building the product. Now they have to be experts either in tax or what a definition of a broker is, if you will. The worst part about this is ultimately still benefits the large because the tax and the time it takes can be absorbed by a large player. So maybe if I'm Google or if I am BlackRock, I actually want this because they will be the only survivors who can weather this and new innovation will be completely pushed offshore. New jobs will be created offshore. And it's still kind of ironic that this all started because of a Jobs Act. This is actually the opposite of a Jobs Act in the US. And there's no doubt this only gets things more centralized and allows scale players to operate, even if they, if that's assuming they want to in this space after this.
So just to like put real numbers on that, the IRS recently, someone from the IRS recently said at a conference that they anticipate that the number of new 1099s annually filed under these proposed regulations would be 8 billion. Currently, at least as of 2020, which is the latest data that we have, the entire universe of 1099s, like dividends, interest, you know, gross proceeds, et cetera, is 3.2 billion, right? So we're
I don't see how this math adds up. I mean, it just would be an enormous burden.
I don't even know how the IRS would
process. That's what I mean, how they would even process it.
That's why I think this is really more of a play to just kill innovation than to actually help taxpayers. In addition, the IRS's own math in the preamble to the proposed regulations estimates a cost of $9.40 per 1099 DA. So we're talking, and you know, they give some numbers as to how many brokers they think would be affected. Just using their numbers, we're talking a cost to each broker of $14.9 million per year. Again, we're talking like leanly staffed, like startups, right? almost $15 million per year, not including startup costs, or in the aggregate, $75.2 billion a year. The equivalent of nearly 600,000 new full-time jobs just to do compliance.
There we go. We get to the jobs part of the Jobs Act.
Right. But kind of perverse, right?
But that's also assuming that the trajectory and the growth of the industry continues at this pace, not assuming that all the jobs, there will be no market for this and the jobs will move offshore and there is zero to collect.
I mean, that's the thing. It's just not possible, right? It's just not possible for someone who hosts a website. Look, I can host a website. It's not possible for someone who hosts a website to spend $15 million a year. And by the way, I actually think that those numbers are probably optimistic because the preamble says that those numbers are based on people who are currently brokers, right? So like your JP Morgan's and your Bank of America's, et cetera, people who already have systems in place to prepare 1099s. But you're talking about capturing people who have no systems in place, no reason to have systems in place, no experience collecting and safeguarding information. Really, I mean, if these proposed regulations are finalized, like that's just it. You can't. People won't be able to comply, and what we'd be left with, if anything, is a few very large players, just a small number of very large players who serve as the gateway to, all of digital assets. So you're effectively just re-centralizing something that's supposed to be digital cash. Right?
And you're also not following through on the promise of making financial services more available to people because you're creating even more barriers. Last I looked, there was no VC that was funding a seed or series A with an extra $1.5 million for compliance. Right. So, it's just...
Yeah, that's a great point. Equity arguments and accessibility as well.
Yeah.
So, I feel like this has been a great session, bringing together the legal perspective, industry, and university academic perspectives. I am a realist, but I also am an optimist, and sometimes those don't go together, but I want to end on an optimistic note and try to understand or set that from you, how, so we know, kind of setting aside what we've been talking about here, if you, what would you like to see in terms of the U.S. supporting innovation in the crypto space? So can we end on a positive and upbeat note about the future of crypto and how the U.S., if it's trying to be kind of promotional about it, how it would go about doing that?
So I'll let Susan and Jason discuss how regulation can be done in an optimistic way. But from a builder and technology perspective, I think what you have immediately would be obviously a deluge of jobs out of the U.S. for sure, and you won't collect any taxes, and so it'll be detrimental. But I think in the long run, they will go to places like Singapore or parts of Europe, and I'm already seeing it in my daily business, the partnerships that we're signing up, the velocities far greater in Asia and in Europe already. But in the long run, there are things that people can do from a technology perspective to solve some of these issues. Ava Labs is already working on what we call an NTT. It's like an NFT, it's a non-transferable token, which contains your PII and your identity. So maybe it's the case where at Starbucks example, where you can obfuscate your detailed information, but that token, which is validated, has your information, and that can be the thing that allows you to get that coffee in a seamless way. There will be other ways where people will create what they call, private tokens, where they have the functionality of audit within the token itself, and so that it's based on the key you have, so you can show it in terms of providing the transaction data. So as a technologist, There will be ways to address this, but that will be far into the future. And after many jobs have moved offshore, and a competitive lead in this space will not be in the US.
Thank you, John.
Yeah. Jason? I mean, the IRS has a really great opportunity here to lead. And I think, you know, the personnel at the IRS are really, really smart. Again, I've spoken with them about substantive issues relating to digital assets. And, you know, I've found them to be, very engaged. It's really unfortunate that, we have this regulatory package that addresses reporting of digital asset transactions that are like fairly esoteric, right? Like decentralized finance and whatnot, before we even have rules relating to those transactions. So that's sort of another, another like thread that we didn't really explore in this conversation. But just for background, like we tax lawyers don't even know how many very basic transactions are treated from a US tax perspective. Rather than sort of focusing on killing the industry, it would be wonderful if the IRS could issue some guidance on how very basic transactions are treated. In the meantime, I think it is important for 1099 reporting to exist for centralized entities, right? I still need a 1099 from Coinbase or Kraken or Gemini if they sell tokens on my behalf, because those tokens are not being sold on a blockchain. So they're being sold sort of within, a private ledger maintained by those centralized entities. I think it would be wonderful if the regulations were finalized insofar as they apply to centralized entities. And maybe the IRS could start a real dialogue with market participants on how best to use blockchain technology instead of a form that's existed since 1917 to actually determine people's tax liability from self-custodied transactions. And that might include just looking at the blockchain. I mean, it's really important to realize that like everything is public on a blockchain, right? So if the IRS has, if a centralized exchange were to report to the IRS, the wallet into which I withdraw my tokens, right? The self-custodied wallet into which I withdraw my tokens. And then the IRS can just use very simple software, which already exists, by the way, to track my tax liability from transactions that I do in self-custody. I use that software to prepare my own taxes every year, right? I plug in my wallet address into, token tax or crypto tax calculator or what have you, and it tells me what my gain or loss is. There is no reason to have a 1099 regime for self-custody transactions when everything is public on the blockchain already. The only reason would be to kill innovation and blockchain innovation specifically within the United States. So, I think, again, it would be really easy for the IRS to work with the industry instead of against it and continue to collect taxes and help taxpayers by enacting a reporting regime for centralized players and beginning a dialogue on the substantive tax treatment of, basic DeFi transactions, wrapping, bridging, liquidity provision, et cetera, to actually provide substantive guidance on how those transactions are treated. And then also put out a request for comments on how best to use blockchain tech to determine people's tax liability. I will note my last note is this has already begun, at least at the legislative level. A few months ago, the Senate Finance Committee put out a request for comments on the taxation of digital assets. They got lots of really good comments. I actually assisted DeFi Education Fund and Polygon in providing comments. There were a lot of other groups that are heavily involved in blockchain tech, both traditional finance and decentralized finance that provided comments. And, you know, it's really unfortunate that the IRS isn't doing something similar.
So
Susan, let's give you the last word. Yep.
So I watched what's, you know, what's going on in the House and the Senate, and I see that there's definitely a movement and bills in play to try and define this industry to give the U.S. a competitive advantage. It's unfortunate that agencies, some of them would prefer to go after this industry through enforcement rather than talking to the industry and creating rules that can effectuate it. I wonder at what point that we look at it and say, oh, whoops, we let all of our innovation go overseas. You know, you have a very painful example of innovation overseas in FTX. For whatever you thought of it, I mean, we all know that there's a guilty verdict. The fact of the matter is that was offshore and people got hurt and lots of people got hurt. So I'd prefer that we have legislators and regulators who try and work with us, because it's not like we don't want to be here. We absolutely want to be here. All of us are from the USA on this call, and we are promoting USA business. So we would love to work with everybody who wants to work with us. But being slapped down and backdoored isn't an effective way to really make the industry flourish and the potential economic gains happen. And I think that's really important to note, because mostly we don't talk about this in terms of potential economic gains and jobs. And I think that that's, those are critical factors that the US has to contend with. And if we want to stay on the cutting edge of being competitive, we need to make sure that we are able to facilitate that. A while back, there was a proposal from the SEC, which was never acted on, to create kind of a lab, a trial period for people to try and create their businesses for 2 years. Whether or not you agree with that approach, that was at least a positive approach from a regulator, again, never enacted. But those kinds of things are really things that would help us move forward. And that's what I want to see. And I am encouraged to see what is happening in the House and the Senate. But yet you don't want all of their efforts to fall on their face when a backdoor agency can come, and I'm saying using a backdoor, and basically slice the industry at its knees.
Well, I think we will leave it there. Thank you, Susan, John, and Jason. We appreciate all of your thoughtful analysis. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Thank you.